Good morning and welcome to Under the Olive Tree, the Canadian-Palestinian radio show. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This is our first broadcast. It's Thursday, the 17th of November, 2005 at 11 o'clock Eastern Time, and I am Laith Marouf, your host for the hour. Under the Olive Tree is more than just a radio show. This program has two main purposes. One, to provide the Palestinian community in Canada with access to the skills and equipment of radio production. Two, in order to allow this community to produce coverage and content that really represents it. We welcome volunteers from across the country. So if you'd like to join us, email us at uot@ckut.ca. Those are our initials of Under the Olive Tree. uot@ckut.ca. Before we tell you of what we have on the show here, our premiere show, I would like to dedicate this show to my mother, Rehab Kilani, who passed away 2 years ago on November 15th, 2003. My mother was and still is remembered as one of the warrior women of her generation, who throughout her life worked to organize the Palestinian community in the face of colonialism, apartheid, and diaspora. She instilled in me and my siblings an unerasable identity that no matter how far we strayed, we never forgot who we are. It has to be said that Palestinian women are the only reason we as a people still exist and resist. These mothers carried the weight of our struggle on their shoulders. Again, welcome to our premiere show of Under the Olive Tree, Canada's Palestinian community radio show. The show today has a great lineup. We will hear from Norman Finkelstein, professor from New York, about his new book, Beyond Chutzpah. His book talking about human rights violations in Palestine and the record, actually, of the Israeli government as recorded by the mainstream human rights organizations across the globe. We will go on after that to an interview with Avi Mughrabi, an Israeli director who has made a new documentary called Avenge But One of My Two Eyes. His new documentary has intriguing historical analysis of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Our last interview is with Raya Hamdan, member of SPHR Concordia, Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. They are putting together a fundraiser that is called We Shall Remain, that will be happening tonight, Thursday, in Sala Rosa. We will go to those details later on. We will go to our first segment of the day with Professor Norman Finkelstein. The interview was conducted by Aaron Lakoff and myself last week. Professor Finkelstein spoke at McGill University in a lecture hosted by Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, SPHR McGill. Here is the interview.
My name is Aaron Lakoff, and I'm joined with Laith Marouf of Under the Olive Tree. And we are here in the studio today with our very special guest, Professor Norman Finkelstein. Norman is a professor at DePaul University in Chicago, where he teaches political theory. He is the author of 5 books, including his most recent one, Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. Welcome to the program, Professor Finkelstein.
Thank you for having me.
Anti-Semitism. And this term clearly plays a part in all of this. What is the role of that term there?
The main purpose of these claims of a new anti-Semitism, which, by the way, they come up roughly every 15 years or so, every time Israel comes under attack for its human rights record, whenever international pressures are put on Israel to solve the Israel-Palestine conflict diplomatically, whenever Israel faces a public relations debacle, as it did with the Second Intifada, The organization supporting Israel, the apologists and the so-called supporters, they revived this extravaganza called the New Anti-Semitism. You could see in 1974, the head of the ADL, the so-called Anti-Defamation League, the main so-called Jewish defense organization, the head of it back then was a fellow named Arnold Foster. And he and his colleague, Benjamin Epstein, they put out a book, and the title was The New Anti-Semitism. And in 1981, the head of the ADL is a fellow named Nathan Perlmutter. He and his wife put out a book, and the title is The Real Anti-Semitism, and the claim is there's a new anti-Semitism. So this is a revival, what we're currently going through. The only thing that's really a little bit different about the current campaign is who's being targeted. It used to be that you used to target organizations which were pretty much on the left or had good solid records of courage, like the National Council of Churches. So they were called, in days gone by, the new anti-Semites. In the current campaign, which began around 2001, the main targets are very mainstream organizations. So Human Rights Watch is anti-Semitic, and Amnesty International is anti-Semitic, and all of the mainstream media are anti-Semitic. We're reaching the sort of terminal phase of this lunacy where everybody in the world is anti-Semitic, because they're all saying the same thing, and the same thing they're saying happens to be called, in normal language, it's not called anti-Semitism, it's called the truth. And the truth is that Israel's record in occupied territories is horrendous.
Perhaps you could describe some of the implications. You mentioned a lot of these groups, which many would deem to be fairly mainstream groups, such as Amnesty International. Mm-hmm. What are the implications?
Well, the implications are basically twofold. Number one, it's used to discredit all criticism of Israel, the claim being that those who are expressing the criticism are covert or overt anti-Semites. And the second main aim is to turn Jews into the victims. So whereas in the case of Israel-Palestine, it's Jews who are the perpetrators, by making this claim of a new anti-Semitism, which according to the current head of the ADL, Abraham Foxman, I prefer to call him the Grand Dragon of the Jewish Citizens Council, Abraham Foxman, he claims that Jews are now facing a threat akin to, if not worse, than the one Jews faced in the late 1930s in Europe. Well, this is pure lunacy. This has nothing to do, but it's supposed to conjure up the image of Jews as being the victim. And it's very convenient. So instead of the real victims gaining attention, namely the Palestinians, it's the perpetrators who are now being turned into the victims. And it's spread everywhere. It's a revolting flunky of the United States, Kofi Annan. He gives these speeches saying that there's nothing more important in the world today than to recognize the uniqueness of the Holocaust. Well, you would think somebody who's coming from Africa would raise his or her eyebrows a little about this notion of the uniqueness of the Holocaust. Africa has experienced its mass exterminations, and now the United Nations has declared January 27th Holocaust Day, and everybody in the world has to, on January 27th, I don't know, go into mourning or fast, who the hell knows what. This is all just, it's pitiful. The cowardice, the fear, the cravenness to the United States and these Jewish organizations. It's really a revolting display of human cowardice. It's terrible.
So, Finkelstein, if you can tell us as a Jewish person, if you can explain to us what you believe is the place and responsibility of Jewish people in North America in regard to this oppression of the Palestinian people that is happening?
Well, first of all, I don't think these are specifically questions which, as a Jewish person, I should be answering. I am Jewish, but I don't think there's a particular Jewish perspective that ought to be sought. There's an ordinary moral perspective which any decent human being ought to support. On the other hand, I think there is a fair core to your question, which is that there's no question that the colossal suffering that Jews endured during World War II is being used, manipulated, and hijacked to justify the oppression of the Palestinians. And to the extent that it's being done in the name of Jews, then I think in the name of Jews, in the name of the historical suffering of Jews, then plainly there's a special responsibility among Jews to repudiate the exploitation of Jewish suffering for an evil cause. And in that respect, I think your question is quite accurate. I don't think there's a special perspective, but there is a special responsibility. When you're being used, or the suffering of your group is being used for an evil cause, then you have a special responsibility to say, as many Jews have said, not in my name.
This ties us up again with some of the experiences that we had here in Montreal, the Palestinian community or people that are working on Palestinian issue. You talked about people comparing the situation now that is the Jewish people are facing is compared to the 30s. Mm-hmm. That is something that was brought up here in 2002 when Netanyahu came to Concordia University. Mm-hmm. At the time, some of the Israeli lobby organizations called that day Kristallnacht again, mm-hmm. because one plane of glass broke. Such a weird thing. But I would like to ask something that is somehow connected to your book here. Lately, you have been talking and debunking of Dershowitz's book, The Case of Israel.
I think you should explain for your listeners. I'm not sure how well known he is in Canada. Who is Alan Dershowitz and why I focused on his book? Would you like me to do that, or would you like to do that?
Well, I can. You can bring it up, but okay. What I wanted to ask is actually to put it in a larger context, because I'm sure you're sick of hearing, you know, people asking you that same question, mm-hmm. why and what's wrong with the book. But putting it in a larger context in what is happening to academic freedoms and the independence of what used to be called the sanctuary of thought, the university.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that is a good question, and I can speak on a personal, practical level on that. My book came out, the latest book, Beyond Chutzpah, came out in late August after a huge battle. Professor Dershowitz of Harvard Law School and a prominent figure in American public life, he wrote a book entitled The Case for Israel, came out in 2003. It was a huge international bestseller, and I went through the book, and the book is a complete fraud from start to finish. There's a difference of opinion, perhaps, and where start begins. Some people think it's the first word of the first page in the book, and some people think it's the first name of the author that the fraud begins. I happen to be of the second persuasion. I think the fraud begins with the author's name. I don't think Alan Dershowitz wrote the book. In any case, a huge battle ensued for about a year, with Professor Dershowitz trying to suppress publication of the book. Eventually, he failed in his efforts, and the book came out. But the truth of the matter is, the book came out only in a very technical sense. That is to say, it was published, there's paper, there's a cover, and so forth. But so far as public life in the United States is concerned, the book never happened. There hasn't been a single interview. I haven't done a single mainstream interview. There hasn't been a single mainstream review of the book. Nothing. It's completely non-existent. I have to even say alternative radio, like my old friend Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, didn't want to have me on, which was a big disappointment, I have to say. The only place I've been able to talk about the book and talk about the relevant issues have been college campuses. And so if you were to go to my website and look at my speaking engagements, you'll see it's college campus, college campus, college campus, college campus. And in fact, the college campuses are the last haven of open expression on this particular issue. which is unsurprising, and therefore it's unsurprising why Jewish organizations have been claiming the past few years that the main manifestations of this so-called new anti-Semitism are college campuses, because it's college campuses which where the kinds of fear and control are not as forceful as everywhere else. I have to say, to the credit of Arab organizations on college campuses, who face all sorts of pressures every time I'm invited to speak. You would think there is a hysteria. Actually, just today, if you look at the Harvard University website, the Harvard Crimson, they have this big editorial that Finkelstein should be allowed to speak. Because when I spoke there last Thursday, there were all these hecklers. Really pretty obnoxious, I have to say. So the Arab organizations, in the case of Harvard, it was the Students for Justice in Palestine, and they have found the courage, and I have to say it is courage, because they come under lots and lots of pressure, and in places like Harvard Law School, it's career destroying. It is career destroying to invite me. That's the only place left. Mainstream radio, forget television, it's out of the question. Mainstream radio, mainstream reviews, you know, absolute zero. You know, I was once on CBC. I debated this fellow, I can't remember, from the Canadian Jewish Congress, a complete imbecile. And the emails had started to come in, and you knew, and I'm perfectly aware of it, that it's the first time and it's the last time. I'll never be on again. And many people have tried to get me on CBC and tried very hard and talk to people there. It's out of the question. Not because what I say is particularly controversial. It's not. It's completely within the mainstream of what human rights organizations have to say. It's because mostly people are just terrified of these organizations and these hoodlums and thugs who browbeat everyone into silence.
Moving over to Israel-Palestine, which made international headlines throughout late August of this year during Israel's withdrawal of the settlements in the Gaza Strip. Mm-hmm. Much of the North American mainstream media hailed this as a step forward for peace in the region. However, you've written quite differently. Can you explain what you understand to be the real story behind the Gaza disengagement?
Well, first of all, you know, the whole Gaza thing was like a Steven Spielberg epic. I wouldn't be surprised if the Israelis had called him in for advice on how to stage this Cecil B. DeMille-sized extravaganza. Probably nothing seen like it since, you know, Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments or something like that. And the second point is, my view is not at all, you know, unique. You look at what human rights organizations have to say. On August 19th, Human Rights Watch issued a statement, and the statement said, there's no end to the occupation of Gaza. They said that if you're inside Gaza or you redeploy on its periphery, nothing has changed. And in fact, the principle is understood by any rational human being. If the jailers in the prison throw the keys to the prisoners, enabling the prisoners to get out of the cells, but then the jailers redeploy on the periphery of the prison and shut tight the gates, well, the prisoners are still in prison. Nothing has changed. Yes, it's true, they're no longer confined to their cells. They can move freely within the prison. But the fact that they're still in prison hasn't changed. In fact, as uncontroversial a person as James Wolfensohn, who is the special envoy of the so-called quartet for Israel-Palestine, Wolfensohn wrote a letter two weeks ago in which he says, quote, Israel is acting as if the withdrawal never happened, which is exactly correct because the withdrawal didn't ever happen. That's simply some theatrics by the media. heartrending scenes of these poor settlers who have to leave the places they were illegally occupying for 40 years and wreaking mayhem and wrecking the lives of the indigenous population. And they were being given $150,000 to $400,000 to relocate everywhere. But our hearts were supposed to be broken over that. So it was nice theater. As to the prospects for Gaza, the prospects are horrible. The world's leading authority on the Gaza is a senior researcher at Harvard named Sarah Roy. And Sarah Roy analyzed it. You can look in the current issue of the London Review of Books, the November 4th issue, I think. It's a very long article, and she writes that Gaza, the Palestinians remain Gaza remains an imprisoned enclave. And the most likely scenario is things are going to get worse there. Israel's not allowing, before the disengagement, about 6,500 Palestinians from Gaza were allowed to enter Israel each day for work. By September, it was down to 100. By October, it was down to zero. They're imprisoning them there and waiting for them to just reach points of desperation. As for the real story of Gaza is, the real story is that Gaza was simply used as a diversion for the complete destruction of the West Bank. As far as we can see now, there are several processes occurring simultaneously. Israel's construction of the wall will take in about 10% of the West Bank, including its most fertile land and its crucial water resources. The wall will divide the West Bank into two, a northern sector and a southern sector. Israel is now implementing what Betzalel, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, what Betzalel calls an apartheid-like road regime, prohibiting Palestinians on most of the roads, which are now designated for Jews only. And the whole of the West Bank is being broken up into three fragments, disconnected fragments, which will be surrounded by Jewish settlements. Overall, for anyone who's familiar with the Bantustans, it very much resembles the Bantustans in South Africa during the apartheid era. They were composed of what were called major and minor fragments surrounded by white South African settlements. And it's very similar to now what's happening in the West Bank. As to what will happen to the Palestinians, my guess is Israel is now hoping that Palestinian life will become so destitute and so desperate that quietly and without fanfare, they're going to gradually disappear. And I think there's probably a good chance of that happening. The obvious analogy is what happened in Lebanon, where there was a huge Palestinian refugee population, but the Lebanese put very strict controls on the work to which Palestinians were eligible. So there was something like 22 categories of work which no Palestinian was permitted. And what happened was the refugee population in Lebanon, without any fanfare, without any public protest, it just radically depleted, with Palestinians finding a way to make their way to Europe. And so the actual, if you look at the official statistics, it's supposed to be like 600,000 or so Palestinian refugees in the camps, but the actual number now is down to like 100,000 or so. They disappeared. And I think that's what Israel is hoping is going to happen in the West Bank, that life will become so absolutely intolerable, so completely unbearable, that without fanfare, the Palestinians are gradually going to disappear. Now, it's a long process, but Zionists have always been very good at seeing the long term. They have an excellent balance. And when I say Zionists, I mean the old school, and Sharon is part of the old school. He's not like these people like Netanyahu, who are just, pretty much these corrupt crooks who don't care about Zionism or anything. They just care about one ism, me-ism. The old school people like Sharon, they are Zionists. And the old school was always able to balance the long-term goals with the short-term victories. They had a very good sense of how to proceed in the what they used to call goat by goat, dunam by dunam. Dunam is the measure of land. How to do goat by goat, dunam by dunam, do these incremental short-term victories, always keeping the larger vision in mind. And, you know, after 120 years, they did very well, for sure, given what they started with. And I think they still have the long-term vision. Gradually, slowly, they'll force all the Palestinians out and make it an all-Jewish Palestine. I don't think it's altogether far-fetched.
نازلا من نحلة الجرح القديم إلى تفاصيل البلاد وكانت سنة انفصال البحر عن مدن الرماد وكنت وحدي ثم وحدي هي وحدي وأحمد كان اغتراب البحر بين رصاصتين مخيما وينجب زعترا ومقاتلي وساعدا يشتد في النسيان ذاكرة تجيء من القطارات التي تمضي وأرصفة بلا مستقبلين وياسمين وأرصفة بلا مستقبلين وياسمين كان اكتشاف الذات في العربات في المشهد البحري في ليل الزنازين الشقيقة في العلاقات السريعة والسؤال عن الحقيقة في كل شيء كان أحمد يلتقي بنقيده 20 عاما كان يسأل 20 عاما كان يرحل 20 عاما كان يسأل 20 عاما كان يرحل 20 عاما لم تلده أمه إلا دقائق في إناء الموت وانسحبت يريد هوية فيصاب بالبركان سافرت الغيوم وشردتني ورمت معاطفها الجبال وخبأتني يريد هوية فيصاب بالبركان سافرت الغيوم وشردتني ورمت معاطفها الجبال وخبأتني 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 خبأتني خبأتني
You are still listening to Under the Olive Tree on CKUT 90.3 Radio McGill in Montreal. That was Natasha Atlas singing a poem called The Arab Wound Al-Jurh Al-Arabi. This song comes from a collection of songs by Marcel Khalifa in an album entitled Ahmad Al-Arabi, Ahmad the Arab. This whole album is a musical narration of Mahmoud Darwish's collection of poems by the same title, Ahmad al-Arabi, Ahmad the Arab. Our next interview is with Avi Mughrabi, an Israeli documentary filmmaker who has made a beautiful documentary called Avenge But One of My Two Eyes. We have interviewed him as he presented his documentary to the International Film Festival, Nouveau Monde de Montréal. Here is the interview. We encourage you to watch the documentary. Avi, what made you make a documentary like this, and what does those myths of Masada and Samson, how does that fit in the history, the current history of what's happening in Palestine, Israel?
Well, look, those myths are really fundamental myths of the Israeli culture and heritage. I didn't have to dig them out from somewhere. It's once you want to discuss death culture in Israeli society, which is what I was after. You know, this started when the discussion about the death culture of Islam was very vivid in the beginning of 2002. So I decided to look at our own death culture, and of course, Samson and Masada are our most obvious choices.
A lot of the reports that I read on the documentary, some of them have been negative, especially people that were writing them were supportive of the Israeli government actions. What do you think is important about using people's mythology to activate such feelings in them so people can question their background and find in their background solutions? How do you see this fitting in your job as a documentary maker?
Look, my job as a documentary maker is not to change the world. I'm afraid I do not believe that this is either my task or anybody's task, or that this can be achieved. You know, documentary is just a documentary. It's a little a tiny piece in a big construction of maybe changing some kind of awareness. I try in all my films, I try to say something about my society, about where I live, about moral preferences, about our political preferences. And this is exactly what I try to do in this film. I don't think that I thought or hoped that once you watch the film, you will have your awareness really changed. Maybe a little bit awakened, but no more than that.
How was the reception in the different parts of the world that you visited and showed this documentary? How was it different from one place to another? Let's say you have shown the documentary yesterday at the film festival here in Montreal. How was that different, let's say, from showing it in Israel?
Well, here in Montreal, strangely enough, you cannot tell how the people felt, because there was, unlike any other festival, there was no Q&A here after the screening. So you can't really know what the people think or you know, what the people got from the film, because those who don't recognize you outside and stop to talk to you, you don't know what they think. Basically, in Israel, the film was the reviews, the critics in Israel wrote wonderful things, really wonderful things. Oddly enough, the best review the film received was from the military's radio station, which is something that you wouldn't expect for such a film. But apparently, Israel is more complex than one expects. So I think anywhere I go, the audience basically splits to two. I can't tell you the exact proportions, but There are people who are very supportive of the film, and there are people who find it very painful and try to fight back.
One thing that was noticeable in the documentary is that it was a snapshot of the moment that is happening while we are looking at the past also of the historical past of Israel. Where do you think the future is going, and which way, as a person that is in touch with people on the ground there, which way do you see it going?
I'm afraid you can't tell. I'm a very pessimistic person. I'm also I think the situation doesn't leave too much for optimism. I can't see a big change happening. People give the Gaza evacuation a lot more value than it deserves, because the basic situation in Gaza has not changed. It still is a very big prison. So the prisoners have more freedom to walk inside the prison now, but it still is a huge prison. And there is a big fear that the government, the prime minister, has decided to evacuate Gaza only in order to regain the international community's support and actually to enhance our hold of the rest of the occupied territories, the West Bank. So I can't see too much good happening soon, but, you know, I don't think that any of us 20 years ago would have believed that South Africa apartheid will be over and that South Africa will turn into a democracy, and, well, not the perfect democracy, but absolutely very different from what it was. So maybe we are too close to the situation, and maybe in 20 years we will have a lot to be happy about.
Do you see any possibility, as you know, as you just mentioned now, the situation in apartheid South Africa, of forgiving and moving on? Is that possible? Because a lot of the media tells us that that's not possible.
I think it's absolutely possible. Whenever you go to the occupied, whenever I go as an Israeli to the occupied territories, and once it's clear to the Palestinians that I meet that I come on with good faith, me and my friends, my other activists, are accepted in an unbelievably warm way, and people are actually very, very happy to be in contact and to talk and to fantasize about the end of all this. So I think it's the people will not be the obstacle for peace. It's I think we have a problem with the politicians, and we have a problem having someone to move us to a brave kind of solution. The people, I think, are waiting for the next step.
We have read also that in 1982, yourself, you have refused service in the Israeli Defense Forces in Lebanon, and you served, I guess, time as the other refuseniks have done in the 1980s. But now there's a link with the next generation of your family, I hear?
Yes. My son, Shaul, who is 19 years old, was supposed to enlist to the Israeli army, to the IDF. But for moral and political reasons, he decided not to become a soldier of the occupation. And he's now in jail for refusing to enlist to the Israeli army. He's been sentenced last Sunday for a fourth term of 21 days. What the army does now is sentence those kids who refuse to go to the army to short terms in military jail, and when they come out, they are asked to enlist again. If they refuse, which is what it did, they are sentenced again for another short term, and then they come out, refuse, sentenced again. So it's like they're trapped in a revolving door of military prison.
And is there any way where our listeners can access this information or send their support to your son and the other refuseniks?
Absolutely. This information is available at the website of the Refusers Parents Forum. It's www.refuse.org.il. Where they can, the website is not fantastic, but they can access information in English and find the petition demanding to release the conscientious objectors and more information about past conscientious objectors.
It is very important to support the voices that bring forward solutions and bring humane treatment to the situation in Palestine, Israel. Thank you very much again, Avi, for being with us. And people should be going to watch this movie. It's amazing. Thank you very much.
It's actually starting next week on October 28th on both Excentris and Cinema de Parc. Okay. Thank you very much.
Have a nice day, Avi.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
أكتب في كل مكان القدس.
Welcome back to Under the Olive Tree on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. That was a song performed by Al Ansar Palestinian Folklore Group. This song is a poem by Tawfiq Zayadi, one of Palestine's famous poets. The song is entitled Atin, which means it is coming. And the lyrics of the poem go, my homeland was occupied, my homeland has become free, and the aggressor occupier was, and today he has become just a memory. That day is coming near, that day is coming near. We will go to our last interview. It is with Raya Hamdan, one of the organizers for a fundraiser that is happening tonight called We Shall Remain. And the interview was conducted by Sabine Fersinger, one of Under the Olive Tree's collective members in Montreal. Here we go to the interview.
Today at Under the Olive Tree, we have an interesting guest with us, Raya Hamdan, who is an organizer of a Palestinian cultural show which will be happening tonight at the Sala Rosa. She is also one of the main performers at the show. So, Raya, can you tell me a little bit about the event you're organizing?
The event tonight was basically a combination and collaboration of hip-hop and spoken word from various artists around Montreal, mainly Palestinian. It's basically to promote the Palestinian cause throughout Montreal. It's a cultural night, and it's just a bit of a call-out to those who are aware of the situation, and to those who aren't, it's a bit of a briefing on it in a more dynamic and more unique way than the usual news.
And We Shall Remain is the title of the event. Can you tell me why you chose that title?
The reason we chose this is because it being so simple, like We Shall Remain is such a simple title, and basically it outlines the Palestinian struggle and the Palestinian conflict, stating that the Palestinians will continue to struggle, will continue to fight, we're not going anywhere, we'll continue to demand our land and our territory and our identity most importantly, and that's why it's We Shall Remain, because we're really not going anywhere.
And what is the significance of holding this kind of event here in Montreal at this current time?
With so many things happening in the Middle East, like in Jordan and in Iraq and Palestine, having an event like this just helps create awareness around Montreal. Being in the international arena, we need to find different and dynamic ways to do this. And cultural nights like this one, where we can have people come in, enjoy their time, at the same time send out a message, is just crucial.
So there's an occupation in Palestine. Can you tell me how this occupation has influenced Palestinian culture, and if it has at all?
Of course, the occupation, Palestinian culture has been based around the occupation. Palestinian culture is about identity, and identity is tied down to territory. And so the occupation just pushes Palestinians to confirm their identity in an even stronger way, and in an even more, And so, through that, the Palestinian culture has been created. Not to say that the occupation is the only reason or the only thing around Palestinian culture. Of course not. These are a people, a land, as every land has a culture, as do the Palestinians. But the occupation, of course, helps in enforcing that identity.
And what is the role of culture and art and poetry and music and in resistance movements? What role has it played in your opinion?
Well, the thing is that because the world is moving into more of a globalization, a globalized world, things like art and music and hip-hop and spoken words are ways of crossing the borders of Palestine in order to get their culture and their message out. And through this, music can be heard anywhere. If you sing it here, you can hear it in Japan, Somalia, Canada, or America. It's the same message that can go out to so many people. So by using these methods, our message can be taken out and carried throughout the world in a much more, in an easier way, and so that people can digest it comfortably rather than like on the news where it's just like bombs and whatnot.
Can you tell me about if people want to go to the event, find out info about it, what do they do?
Well, basically, the event is going to be held tonight at La Sala Rosa at 4848 Saint Laurent. Tickets are $7 at the door. You can call 961-3162 or 999-1682 for more information. But basically, and you can also log on to the SBHR website to just find out directions or whatnot.
Which is www.sbhr.org. Yeah. Perfect. Okay, thank you very much, Gaia. Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights presents We Shall Remain, a night of poetry and resistance. Please join Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights for an evening to pay homage and to celebrate the cultural modes of resistance through which Palestinians have survived and maintained their identity in the face of immeasurable odds. The night will consist of resistance through hip-hop, poetry, spoken word, traditional Arabic music, short films, and, of course, live music. Featuring in the evening as artists and poets and musicians, we have Gaia Hamdan, a local Palestinian poet, activist, and artist who we've heard from earlier, Rafif Ziad, a famous Toronto Palestinian spoken word artist, activist, and also academic, whose spoken word will surely set many people straight, Mark Tetreault, a local Montreal artist and activist, with a totally original acoustic reggae sound. And there's also Icos de Porto Alegre, a local political salsa band that will make everyone shake and dance and think revolution all at the same time. Yassine, a member of a local popular Montreal hip-hop band called Euphrates, will also be sharing his intense rhymes with the public. And finally, The Mental Crew, a spinning and cool hip-hop band, which will put on some Middle Eastern vibes for everyone. And also two short films on Palestinian hip-hop as a form of resistance by Jackie Saloum. And also finally live footage showing a non-violent direct action against the Israeli apartheid wall in the West Bank village of Bilin in July 2005. And this will be presented by Sarita Ahuja. So tonight, you can come to the show at La Sala Rosa at 4848 Saint-Laurent. Tickets will be sold at the door for $7 if you buy them in advance. Anytime before opening, they'll be $5. And for that, you can call 999-1682. And the doors are scheduled to open around 9.
I would like to leave you all with one more song before we leave. It goes with the event that is being held tonight. The song is also called We Shall Remain in Arabic, Baqoon. The poem is again by Tawfiq Zayadi and it states, "Here on your chest we will stay like a wall. Here in your eyes we will stay like a storm of fire. Like 20 impossible in the lid, the Ramla and Al-Jalil. Here we will stay forever." Another show of resistance by the Palestinian communities everywhere. Another show of solidarity. Another show of Under the Olive Tree. Thank you very much for being with us. Until we meet another time under the olive tree, salam to everybody. Salam. Free Palestine.
كأننا عشرون مستحيل في اللد والرملة والجليل. هنا على صدوركم بقونة الجدار وفي عيونكم زوبعة من نار. هنا على صدوركم بقونة الجدار وفي عيونكم زوبعة من نار. هنا نجوم كأننا عشرون مستحيل في اللد والرملة والجليد. إن هنا باقون قد تشرب البحر تحرس ظل الدين والزيتون ونزرع الأفكار كالخمير في العجين. إذا بشنا نعصر الصخرة ونأكل التراب إن جعنا ولا نرحل. هنا لنا ماضي هنا لنا حاضر هنا لنا مستقبل. هنا لنا ماضي هنا لنا حاضر هنا لنا مستقبل. هنا على صدوركم بقونة الجدار وفي عيونكم
وننشد الأشعار وننشد الأشعار.